This is a download from the BBC. For more information and our terms of use, go to bbc.co.uk/radio3.
For many writers, the shape of a story and its true beginning becomes clear only after they complete a draft. But Dickens often steers his novels as he writes, much as we try to steer our lives. It gives a touch of happy madness to it all. At every playful page we turn, we breathe a sigh of relief for having avoided a pitfall or dead end. David Copperfield, the most autobiographical of his novels and his favourite child cast into what he called this shadowy world, begins with these lines.
Whether I shall turn out to be the hero of my own life, or whether that station will be held by anybody else, these pages must show. To begin my life with the beginning of my life, I record that I was born, as I have been informed and believe, on a Friday at 12 o'clock at night. It was remarked that the clock began to strike and I began to cry simultaneously.
Although life begins at birth, it can be a risk to start there in a novel. Even Dickens usually prefers the moment a character is about to enter a new stage in life, often as a result of the death of a parent. A moment open to many possibilities, but loaded with memory. He needs even a child to be conscious, a remembering eye, for memory is the core of all writing. We come to this stage quickly in the next chapter of David Copperfield. Leaving the fanciful image of baby David bawling in his basket, we turn the page and discover, I observe.
The first objects that assume a distinct presence before me as I look far back into the blank of my infancy are my mother, with her pretty hair and youthful shape, and Peggotty, with no shape at all, and eyes so dark that they seem to darken their whole neighbourhood in her face, and cheeks and arms so hard and red that I wondered the birds didn't peck her in preference to apples. I believe I can remember these two at a little distance apart, dwarfed to my sight by stooping down or kneeling on the floor, and I going unsteadily from one to the other. I have an impression on my mind, which I cannot distinguish from actual remembrance, of the touch of Peggotty's forefinger as she used to hold it out to me, and of its being roughened by needlework like a pocket nutmeg grater. This may be fancy, though I think the memory of most of us can go further back into such times than many of us suppose, just as I believe the power of observation in numbers of very young children to be quite wonderful for its closeness and accuracy. Indeed, I think that most grown men who are remarkable in this respect may with greater propriety be said not to have lost the faculty than to have acquired it, the rather as I generally observe such men to retain a certain freshness and gentleness and capacity of being pleased, which are also an inheritance they have preserved from their childhood. I might have a misgiving that I am meandering in stopping to say this, but it brings me to remark that I build these conclusions in part upon my own experience of myself, and if it should appear from anything I may set down in this narrative that I was a child of close observation, or that as a man I have a strong memory of my childhood, I undoubtedly lay claim to both of these characteristics.
The teller of the tale, Dickens suggests through David Copperfield, has a child's eye and a vivid imagination. He rather mischievously seems to suggest that writers must start as children of close observation or become adults who retain a strong memory of childhood. In my first novel, Reef, I seem to have echoed that idea with my narrator, Triton, whose story begins at the age of 11. I had not read David Copperfield at the time, a misdemeanour I blame on my father, partly because the editions of Dickens he had bulging out of his bookcase in my childhood had such fussy fonts. I couldn't read them without my eyes blurring, my head spinning. I much preferred the clean, plain typeface of a crime or spy novel, the wide open spaces of a galloping western. Maybe Dickens would have understood my aversion. Pip, in Great Expectations, drew what Dickens called childish conclusions about his parents' look and character from the letters on his father's tombstone. I took my cue about Dickens from the shapes on the printed page. Also the sound. Charles, for example, in the post-colonial Colombo I grew up in, just would not do for a dashing boyhood hero. The stars of my daydreams had much more enticing names like Zane Grey or Dashiell Hammett. There was also the small matter that Charles was the name of my mother's second husband, my alternative father, but that's another story. More importantly, I think my father loved Dickens too much for me. He would speak of how he too was born in a call, as David Copperfield had been, and often put his faith entirely in luck. And so I steered clear of that sagging shelf of his, although oddly enough his equally strong love of Shakespeare only served to feed mine, as I eavesdropped on his sudden bursts of blank verse between a declaration from Dombey or Nickleby and a glass or two of midnight whiskey. My father's death, a year after Reef was published, gave a Dickensian tinge to my next novel, The Sandglass. I remember my father's words in hospital, very near the end of his life. Macbeth, Act 5, Scene 5. Tomorrow and tomorrow and tomorrow creeps in this petty pace from day to the last syllable of recorded time. He whispered the words theatrically, loving the lines despite his pain and testing their veracity in the clinical light of a cancer ward. Surely this is memory, not imagination, but it does seem like a scene that might be found in a Dickens novel. I was very tempted to put it in mine, and did, in a veiled sort of way. My father was brought back to end his days at his London home, close to the books he had carried from country to country in the wanderlust of the 20th century. I can see him now reaching for a tale of two cities, merging a memory of what was to what might have been. It is a far, far better rest I go to than I have ever known before. I feel I'm beginning to understand why my father loved his Dickens. In his every scene, it seems to me now, the words take on a life of their own. Remember how at the beginning of chapter 2, we heard David Copperfield describe Peggotty as a woman who, unlike his pretty youthful mother, has no shape at all? And then how he plays with the words to breathe life into her between the images he pulls together, her eyes so dark they darken the neighbourhood of her face, and cheeks and arms so hard and red that I wondered the birds didn't peck her in preference to apples. In fast, hectic prose, bursting with vitality, Dickens still manages to fuse his images with the intensity of poetry. Images that he will bring back at the end of the book. It is marvellous, but it is not all. Next, he smuggles in a rather wonderful truth about the connection between memory and imagination, the physical eye and the mind's eye. He writes, "I have an impression on my mind which I cannot distinguish from actual remembrance, of the touch of Peggotty's forefinger as she used to hold it out to me, and of its being roughened by needlework, like a pocket nutmeg grater." The strongest image we are given, and one that we will carry with us in our own memory of that page, is an impression he cannot distinguish from actual remembrance. Peggotty's forefinger as rough as a pocket nutmeg grater. It is so perfect that it does not matter if he, David or Charles, remembers it or imagines it, or even whether the child David ever would have seen it that way. What matters is that it has been truly imagined and made into a memory in us. That, to me, is fiction working at its best, pure magic, the alchemy of a writer's eye, a fresh eye, a free orphan eye. David Copperfield, like many of Dickens' characters, soon becomes an orphan. It is only recently that I realized how important orphans or near orphans are in my own novels. Many of my central characters lose their parents early or become estranged from them. Their escape allows them to see the world in their own individual way and allows me to recreate it as memory on a page. Triton, at the beginning of Reef, has an encounter at a London petrol station which ignites the memory of his childhood when he was sent away from home to become a servant boy in Mr. Salgado's Colombo house. From there, we discover his world. Chip, in The Sandglass, gathers memories from what he has observed of his adopted family, Pearl, and her children to create a memorial. Mark, in Heaven's Edge, searches for what his father had discovered in a distant, war-torn land before his own violent death. And Sonny Fernando, in The Match, uses the lens of a camera, the purest eye, to focus on his life and make a past for himself from his childhood and a future for his son. The novel I've just finished writing has its origins in some unexpected Sinhala letters I found carved on a gravestone far from their Sri Lankan homeland at a crossroads on another island, Mauritius, about 10 years ago. That surprising sight took me on a journey which has become The Prisoner of Paradise, the story of Lucy Gladwell setting out from London about the time Dickens was starting out on his own in the same city, a journey into the unknown, the start of a new life. And as Dickens shows us time and again, this is what we all do every time we begin a novel, whether we are writing it or reading it. Dickens once claimed that he never began to write before having settled the work in its minutest detail in his head. Can that be? No doubt there were moments when he felt in supreme control, but often the writer, however many books he or she might have written before, struggles to be born at the beginning of each new novel. Our squiggles and notes, the half-remembered hopes and passing shadows of lines and images, are like wriggles and cries of a newborn infant. With luck, we progress to crawl around a page and months later begin to stand up delighted as we tentatively find our feet in a manuscript or a typescript or an electronic folder, but still stumble from time to time, trying to match some inner compass to a sense of balance. We try not to walk into corners or bump our heads in a draft we want to somehow perfect. And with each hurdle we manage to jump, we find another bigger one. And suddenly we are 6 or 9 or an adolescent with a novel growing fast out of control. Yes, writing a novel is very much like living. And I suspect even Dickens found that it is not easy to carry the lessons you might have learnt in one book, or one imperfect life, into another. His stories twist and turn. The characters ricochet from one world into another, sometimes by design, sometimes by necessity, and sometimes, I'm sure, simply by chance. Or, as my father might have said, luck. Lucy Gladwell, in my new novel, sails from Gravesend to Mauritius with her Aunt Betty in 1825. Gladwell and Gravesend, I see now, must have been a gift from Dickens. Gladwell is a name that promises bliss and happiness, while Gravesend, which I happened upon, is exactly the word I needed for the beginning of her journey. Lucy, on the brink of adulthood, has been recently orphaned and is at a new stage in her life. On the island of Mauritius, she will meet Don Lamborda, a young man unlike anyone she has ever met before. I hope Dickens would approve of the way their two separate worlds converge and the way very different lives become intertwined with such unexpected results. Is it coincidence, I wonder, that in the last stages of writing the book, Dickens stepped back into my life? 2 years ago, I was lucky enough to have been offered a tall windowed room in Somerset House on the Strand in London to write in for a year. Dickens' father worked in the same building at the time my story is set, and it is said that Charles, as a boy, wandered the corridors in search of his parent. Every week in that room, between sentences, I would sometimes pause and hope he might peek in and offer me a word or two of advice, or his legendary quill pen, which I had been lucky enough to use to scratch my name on a massive ledger kept next door. Perhaps he might even pass me a few of his surplus words, jangling like loose change in a purse. I would look out of the window and hope to catch a bird picking an apple on the terrace, a face in a call, a snatch of conversation between a lawyer and Uriah Heep, my Lucy Gladwell and Steerforth, the dip and squeak of a stray seagull, or the lights of a carnival on the Thames. In the evenings I would look out for my father's hero in this shadowy world. I would wait, ready to dart out, like a Dickens orphan, and pick his pocket of a bit of magic that can turn a finger into a nutmeg grater, a page into a globe.